You are listening to the Murdoch Charitable Trust's 2017 Leadership Advance Conference, Telling the Story, Telling Your Story. The dessert reception and film viewing was led by Terry Stokesbury and John Priddy.
We're so excited for you to see these next three films, and they're all very short, but we're going to do it a little differently. So I'm going to introduce a dear friend. I might as well just turn around and talk to the wall. I'd really like to introduce a dear friend. There we are. Thank you, Scott. So when we decided to do this, what we now call the Ignite video showcase, we asked our friends at the Windwriter Institute if they would curate it for us. Because you could surely ask yourselves, what does the Murdoch Trust know about running a video contest of some kind? And the answer would be nothing. So we asked our friends at Windwriter to curate it for us, so they're the ones that really put it on their shoulders and did the work. So I want to introduce you and let him MC the rest of the evening, my good friend, John Priddy, one of the co-founders and the CEO of Windwriter Institute. So here's John.
I feel like I'm at a bar after the, dinner was served, but my favorite people hang out in bars after dinner. So people are getting dessert in the back. Our filmmakers are here. Do we have everybody? I think we're getting close. Is Brian here? I think we're going to give that line about 5 minutes in the back of the room. Oh, okay. Then why don't we turn on the lights and start the first film?
We have a mighty remnant of film watchers. So those in the back, please come up and join us up here and gather around as I introduce the filmmakers. From The Kite Maker, Brian Wortham is here. Brian, come on up. From The Pants Society, Brandon Deepwell and John Osei, come on up. And from Wondrous, Sebastian Rogers. So it's an amazing thing to be here tonight watching these three films. We were taken to Cairo, Egypt. We were then brought somewhere where pants were important. And then we had beautiful cityscapes of Portland and beautiful vistas of the Pacific Northwest. So three very different films. And we're going to have a time here to have a little Q&A. But first, I'll get it started and ask the filmmakers a few questions. And I've also asked them to keep in mind a question they might have for one another because it's the first time they've seen each other's films. So it's kind of fun. So let's start with you, Brian. I mean, what a beautiful work, The Kite Maker. You know, 2 weeks ago, we all were glued to the news where we saw this tragedy in Egypt where, you know, this mosque was blown up and I felt, because I had seen your film, I felt like I had been to Cairo before. Tell us a little bit about how a filmmaker, a young filmmaker, finds his way to Cairo, to Garbage City, to the largest church in Egypt. What's that process?
I think my understanding of the Middle East started through visiting Israel and learning of the Jewish narrative in that land, which led me to understand that the Palestinian narrative and led me to explore the Arab world. And that brought me to Egypt and eventually Garbage City.
And it feels like such a big project from where we're sitting here. What was the process of, you know, you were led there, but what was the process? How did you get there? How did you come to discover the storyline?
My first time visiting this place, obviously I was overwhelmed by the spectacle of a garbage dump with 400,000 people in it. But I think I was also struck by the joy that these people had. They're living in poverty, but they obviously have happiness, and it's sort of overwhelming when you visit the place how content these people seem in their I guess to reference what was discussed earlier, they have really no authority. But they're totally happy with what they have, and I think that led me to find basically that the kids in Garbage City just brought me so much hope. And you know, honestly, I saw them flying kites on a rooftop, and that was that was what inspired it.
That's like a really good answer. And then you had an issue with the translator. Could you tell us how that worked out for you?
The translator became my wife, who's right here.
Introduce her to the crowd, you know. I love young filmmakers who go there, hire a translator, and then marry them. So that's a wonderful. Well, very good. We have Brandon and Jono from the Pants Society. Now, there are two things that are really hard to do. Comedy with meaning that undergirds it, and to do it in 3 minutes. I mean, and about pants. So I don't. This Q&A is going to take way longer than 3 minutes. The Pants Society. So Brandon, what the heck?
I don't really know what to say. Do you want to talk a little bit about the idea?
We actually wanted to ask you how this all happened. We don't know what the Pants Society is about at all. No, we had a really good time coming up with this, actually. We've known each other for a few years, well, almost over 20 years now. And it's a group of us, and we just kind of love to create stories and, first of all, make ourselves laugh and hopefully make other people laugh, too. So it usually starts with us finding something that gets that reaction out of us, and then we build it up from there. And the story really evolves out of the first laugh for us. So it's an interesting experience. And coming up with this really was, how we got there was really by just doing that, sitting down at a pub called Portland Craft in Vancouver, BC. And now we're in Portland, or next to Portland, in another Vancouver. Both are great, by the way. So, yeah.
That's your next 3-minute documentary. From Portland to Vancouver, from Vancouver to Portland. There you go.
Yeah.
And Sebastian Rogers, you're not from here, but you live here.
I'm from England, but I do live very close to here, across the water in Portland.
So what did we just see with Wondrous? I mean, what a beautiful aesthetic. Tell us about it.
Well, I generally make documentary films, but once a year I do a tithe of a liturgical film, meaning it's designed to go along with a sermon at my church. So the last year, I was given the job of making a film that would be about wonder. And my own experiences of wonder have all been in the natural environment. Like, I've always traditionally gone on a pilgrimage once a year to like the wilderness to spend time with God. But I didn't want to belittle the wonder that man has created, because I know that, you know, there's so much incredible, you know, like, I benefit from it in my everyday life, the wonder of creation that man has made. But it was lacking that transcendence that I experienced, that connection with God through his creation. So I kind of decided to collaborate with a poet at my church, Van Doren Wheeler, who's reading. I actually read that into his Galaxy smartphone, and we always intended to replace it, but then every time he sat down to do a voiceover, suddenly just didn't work. You know, that initial, just him reading me the poem and sending it to me, was the one that ended up on the final film. And the little boy was just because I feel like I kind of wanted to. Yeah, obviously there's the Jesus asks us to approach him like a child, but then at the same time, wonder is something I associate with childhood, and like the loss of wonder is also something I associate with adulthood. So I kind of felt there was like something metaphorical there as well about using a child.
You know. It's beautiful. Three different films, all three beautiful and amazing. And we have the filmmakers up here ready to answer questions, so I hope you're thinking about them. Anybody have a question they'd like to ask any of the individual filmmakers? Well, you are Johnny on the spot. All right, questions for the filmmakers. While you're thinking of that, I've asked the filmmakers to think about how they might ask each other a question. So why don't we start with you, Brian? Do you have a question from somebody else on the panel?
What made you guys decide to shoot the Pants Society with the square aspect ratio? That's a really technical question, but...
I think we went 4x3 just to make it stylistically a little bit different and to kind of stand out and kind of add to that quirkiness that we were kind of going for. Big Wes Anderson fans.
We actually hung out all day, so it makes it kind of weirder because we were supposed to like think of a question we might ask. But I think we asked each other so many questions about each other, even without seeing the films.
Well, we didn't hear the question, we didn't hear the answer.
This is true.
Ask your favorite question, and they give their favorite answer.
It always kind of starts, we get a bit nerdy and we talk tech about that stuff, like what, who shot on what. But this was actually the first time we saw each other's films, which is really interesting. So this is a brand new experience for all of us. But I guess one question I have. You said that you had just seen. I'll ask you about this because it did pop into my head while watching it. You saw them flying those kites, right? And how did you end up reaching into that community of finding those kids and basically pulling that story out? Or did it come quite easily? Did you find, or was it quite a challenge?
Yeah, I want to say the story kind of brought itself to me. Once I took the step and actually showed up in this neighborhood with a camera and with my future wife who was translating, we really just made friends with people on the street, which is so common in Egypt. I've found people in Egypt are probably the most hospitable people in the world. And these kids just wanted to hang out with us, and it actually turned out that we were hanging out with this kid who was well known for making kites, and you can't really plan for something like that, but it was exactly what I was looking for, and he just kind of brought himself to me.
I can ask you a question now.
Sure. John, we have a question right over here, and then I'll run over there.
Today in the Wind Rider presentation, we learned a lot about some of the production that goes into some of the film projects. And just curious for us in the room that don't have as much experience with filming and putting something like that together, for each one of these, what was the production team like? Was it just you guys solo, or did you have help and support? Just the various scale of that for obviously these beautiful visuals that we saw throughout each of them.
I was just me. And the parents to the child who were just making sure that he didn't have a terrible fate befall him in the city, which obviously wandering through the, you know, nighttime city was, you know, you could see his reactions to like coming across homeless people sleeping in doorways. That was all real. That wasn't acted. I was just like, yeah, explore, man. I'll follow you. And that was the same in the forest as well. All those things, that like picking the leaves and twisting the branches, none of it was directed. It was just basically like, and then I would text the poet constantly, like, he just did this, he just did that. And we didn't end up being a linear edit. Like, I intentionally didn't want it to be like one for one. But yeah, it was definitely an ongoing process. And so Henry, the little boy, he basically shaped a lot of the creative process because he wasn't an actor. So I just wanted him to, and I intentionally took him to certain places. I knew he would see certain things and do certain things. But, you know, it was very much led by Henry and his internal spirit. But technically just me.
So I'll answer half of this question, but the first, our crew is actually, like I mentioned, Brandon and I have known each other since grade 2, and we've been making movies for a good chunk of that on and off over the past few years, but all of those guys on screen are friends of 20 years or more, and we've just kind of been doing this for a good chunk of our lives, and just making fun movies and submitting them. But we also did a YouTube channel together for a while. So that's all like 20 years of relationships plus on camera and that kind of chemistry. And your connection to the crew is a little bit more your story.
Yeah. So the crew, we had a sound guy, camera operator,
And then I think it was just me that directed. And those guys, I like, were one of the guys was my neighbor. The other guy lived a few blocks over. So it's literally who's in our neighborhood and who wants to film stuff. And then, yeah, we wrote it together, kind of read over the script and kind of kept tweaking it and just had a lot of fun with it. And I think that's kind of what shows up on screen is just how much fun we had.
One more interesting thing. The guy that takes the tearaways off, Peter, he's our media teacher from high school. We're just stuck in the past. Like, we have a problem.
Holding on to the past, for sure.
We love Peter.
Production was just me for this film. Obviously, my wife translated. And post-production, I had a good deal of help. There was a composer, a friend of mine, did the music, and there was a colorist and a sound designer. Probably against the rules with some philosophies of documentary making, but I had to embellish like what I wasn't able to capture when I was on location because I did sound and I filmed. And I guess I would credit the weather in Cairo for giving me really good light.
Good light, good wife, all in Cairo. And the yes, question.
Yeah, I feel really insufficient in the facial hair department right now, looking at this crew. So
I feel insufficient because they did it by themselves, like with one camera, and yeah. So facial hair, one camera.
In my experience, most filmmakers don't dream about making talking head videos of nonprofit leaders talking about their organizational missions. There's a lot of us represent organizations where we have a story we're trying to tell, and we have to sort of consistently repeat that story in various forms. So would be curious, as artists sort of dedicated to your craft, if you were tasked with leading an organization that had a mission you were really passionate about, how would you stay kind of free to express that artistic expression without getting locked into the talking head video of an executive director that nobody wants to watch? How do you innovate?
Can I take this one?
Yeah, please.
That's actually what I do for a living, is I make films for organizations. So I think I'm really glad you asked that question, because the talking head video of the executive director is like my worst nightmare. So I feel like everywhere through the Bible, the hero of every story is someone from the margins or from the bottom, who is redeeming their people and bringing them to freedom. And that is still the story in America, even though we think that it's the people who give $10 online or the people who are the executive directors of nonprofits, bless you all. The truth is the people actually living independence with God, in struggle, in daily commitment to their faith, are the people that we're serving. So I always tell the story of an organization through the people they're serving, and by putting them in the hero spot, by giving them the limelight, it honors your relationship to them. And who you are is shown through your respect for who they are. And I think that's like a really and fundamental paradigm shift, I think, that we need to change in the way we communicate, especially in the nonprofit world, where it's very much like we try and make a hero of the person donating and a subject for. We've moved past the pity thing. I think we've all evolved past that, but we still haven't evolved into understanding God's true story and how it is told through the people that we serve. So yeah, that's kind of close to my heart. I don't know if anyone else wants to answer.
Great answer. Yeah, thank you. Yeah. Duncan. I think that answer like is a mic drop.
This is for you also. I really love the contrast you did between the child walking through the inner city and then going out back into the wilderness and the woods. Actually, the child walking through the city actually reminded me of my own childhood when I used to wander around downtown alone. Where did you find the child, and how old was the child that's actually in the film?
Oh, actually, I don't know how exactly old he is. I think he was 5 last year. Yeah, I think he was 5. The music is actually by an incredible composer called Michael Blake. If anyone's looking for new music, Michael Blake he's an incredible composer, and that is from an album called, what is the album called? Oh, A Thousand Flowers Bloom. Well, basically, he has been a composer who's worked on many of the films I've made, and it's his son, who I've known since he was like 2. And we've just always had this, we've always played creatively, like we did, like, I play the drums and he raps, do you know what I mean? So we've always had this kind of collaboration since we've ever known each other. And the one thing, that's the reason why I used him, because I had a relationship with him and we could hang out and I wouldn't have to find, you know, a skilled actor in, I only had a few days to make the film, you know, before that I needed to present it for the church. But one thing I really regret, actually, on that subject is that a really good friend of mine who's a mentor is I work with almost exclusively with leaders of color. And when he saw the film, he said, "So why is the kid white?" And I said, the honest answer, which is, well, if I made the kid black, then the subject of the film would be race. And even as I said it, I realized what a terrible travesty that is. And that the... to put kids of color into films that aren't about their race is like fundamental in changing our narrative about people of color, and the fact that they're always in some way viewed as a problem to solve or a, and I really, yeah, it really broke my heart that that was, even with all my supposed awareness of issues surrounding these things, I still didn't even consider for a second using a kid of color just to represent them in a positive light, not just to, you know, the, yeah, it's a travesty that if I had made it a little boy, the questions would have been potentially about, like, why I used a black kid. Do you know what I mean? So I'm glad I got the opportunity to share that. I don't know if that was really your question, but I put it in there.
So I'm a filmmaker as well, and I've shown my films in all kinds of strange venues. What has been some of the reactions to your films, and then what is it like coming to this place, right? Which is a film festival within a conference, right? Slightly different format. So what do you think?
This is the first time that my film has been shown anywhere, so hopefully the response has been good.
This is the reaction to our film. We've actually we've had a really good response to it within our own community of friends in Vancouver, but it's also reached a lot of other people. And we were actually quite surprised at how well it was received, and we got a lot of great feedback on it. We've also, can I say this? We've submitted it. How You Found Us. So you worked with a man in Japan who actually had entered a film contest that we had entered this in as well, and you had stumbled across us during that, and we were made aware of the contest, and it's gotten a lot of great feedback, and we've really enjoyed seeing it go from just something that we thought was just a simple, fun move, little short with a lot of with some themes that obviously run through it. But it's actually resonated with a lot of people, just for simply what it is. And something so simple, the theme is about a few inches of fabric, the difference of that. But it's gotten a lot of great feedback. And being here, it's been really cool to see that integrate into something that actually comes into leadership and how these parallels can be drawn from something that we love to do, and also... that it starts discussion about stuff that everyone else here is obviously quite passionate about. We hope it's resonated with you as leaders. So, but yeah, it's been great.
Because you were putting on an English accent, right? In the film. I would say Mid-Atlantic, okay. Because I wondered if you know that there actually is a really, really contentious issue around trousers and men in England.
We actually are one of our friends who did the original voiceover for the announcer. He was like, "Am I doing an English accent?" We're like, "Yeah, sure, that sounds great." And then he was like, "Well, shouldn't I be saying trousers?" And we were like, "I don't know." It's a North American audience, and we're like, "Wow, this is already starting to cause some cognitive dissonance here." So we, but it worked out. So yeah, it was funny because pants in the UK are underpants.
Well, there's actually. In the Empire, the English Empire, they used to force people of color to wear shorts so they could treat them as boys. So the idea, and it's still really prevalent in the culture, that English men, like American men wear shorts and when it's hot. You'll never see an Englishman, not of a certain class anyway, the ruling oppressive class, would never wear. So actually there was like a cultural, like it had more depth for me, I think, because I was kind of like, yep, you know, like you would get thrown out for wearing shorts, that's for sure.
Yeah. That's why we went halfway mid-Atlantic accents. It's like, no one knows where that is.
Yeah, kind of going off of the question earlier about talking heads, Brian, something I noticed in your film is that you're telling this beautiful narrative about community while giving us statements about Coptic Christians and like informing us in a different way. And that's so subtle and so rare. Can you talk a little bit about, kind of in relation to how you're telling a larger story through this almost like beautiful picture that's saying something a little bit different, what made you tell it in that way?
Sure. What felt subtle and rare? Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, I wanted this story to resonate with people that aren't in the evangelical world. And maybe to answer the other question a little bit more thoroughly, I showed this to a lot of people that aren't believers before I decided that the story was complete in the way that I wanted it to be. And actually, some of the people that I think are like my biggest mentors in storytelling aren't believers. So I it had to make sense to anyone. If it felt that way, I guess I got lucky because it was a really hard balance with the subject matter, but, maybe something about Egypt, actually the country kind of got itself into my story, and there's just something about Egypt that's very humble and very, it's so foreign to evangelical North Americans, I guess. But it's just not a preachy place. Like, people are just themselves, and somehow that got infused into it as well.
Brian, is that correct?
Yeah.
Yeah, so thank you for your film. I was going to ask you, what was it like for that boy, for his friends, for his family, to see their life put in a film? I'm assuming that they got to see some of what you did as they experienced it. Or have they not? And if so, what was the meaning for them in getting a chance to, essentially, you gave them immeasurably more than they could have maybe hoped or imagined. What was that like?
Yeah, that's a really good question. To be honest, the community in Garbage City is so uneducated, to be really blunt. They're so uneducated that we were really apprehensive to show the finished product to them, partially... to a Western audience, like, the music makes sense, it makes it feel beautiful, but to them, we didn't want them to feel ashamed of their lives. They've seen stills from it, but they haven't seen the complete film, which I struggle with, because I feel I want them to see it, but it's still a journey that we're on, actually. We always visit this family every time we're in Egypt, and I would actually love to screen the film in Garbage City, but... we just haven't gotten there yet, so. Yeah, I think Peter is like a really dignified kid, but family structure in Egypt is really complicated, and when we shot the film 2 years ago, so he was like 16 when we shot it, he's 18 now. There was like a mother dove thing going on with his mom, and she was very protective and very skeptical of me at first. We sort of won her over after a couple years of visiting like regularly. But it's just a family structure thing in Egypt that made it really tricky to navigate.
We have time for one more question. Or any other questions? You guys enjoying this panel? It's a good group of filmmakers, very interesting.
question coming in.
Yeah, guys, thanks so much for what you do. I know creative people continue to create. Just curious what you're creating these days. New stuff.
Well, we had a pretty long car ride down here, so we were working on some more ideas and kind of things to write, and yeah, I guess we got a couple 3-minute ideas that we're gonna put to paper when we get back and probably start shooting those.
We only have 3 minutes worth of film in our camera, so film's really expensive these days. So,
well, I work on a lot of films at once, so I'll try and be short, but so I'm working on a series called Love in the Time of Fear, which is with an author. It's a collaboration, and it's going to be a multimedia project, and it's about how marginalized people in our society receive love. Like, we might choose to give love as Christians, but how is it received, and what does it look like for a Muslim or an immigrant or someone from the LGBTQ community? So that's a series of films. I'm also working on a full-length documentary called 11 a.m., Martin Luther King said 11 a.m. was the most segregated hour in America, and I think it's a really terrible witness to the rest of the world that we're so segregated. And a reconciliation ministry run by David M. Bailey, down in West Virginia, down in Richmond, Virginia, is what that film is based around. He does mentorship of young people of color and white people with a mind towards reconciliation. It's to be worship leaders in mainstream churches in order to try and change culture from within. Doing a series of training films for a recipient of the foundational grant, which is Mending the Soul. They have impacted my life in a really big way, and I'm making training films to help them train facilitators to take people through abuse recovery. That's quite a big project. And I've partially shot it, but I'm in the trying to get funding for a long-form documentary about a leader, a Native American leader called Mark Charles, who, if no one here has heard him speak, he's really a revolutionary character who has a great vision for the future of America and the reconciliation of America. And I feel like, in line with the understanding of leaders coming from the bottom, you couldn't get a more marginalized community than Native Americans in America. And I'll say that openly. Having visited them. So that's another long-form documentary I'm trying to get funding for. It's a little more hard, but that's what I'm doing.
I'm working on a project in South Central LA that is about this guy that grew up in Imperial Courts projects in Watts. Spent 10 years in jail, and just a really brief glimpse of his life and what it's like for him now after being out of prison and everything.
So, ladies and gentlemen, we have from the Kite Maker, Brian Wortham. Thank you. We have from the Pan Society, Brandon Deepwell and John Say. Do I pronounce it Say? Say? Well, I got it. And Wondrous, Sebastian Rogers. How about a big round of applause? Thank you, guys. And to all of you, thank you very much for hanging and being with us till late. So we'll see you in the morning.